Welcome to Behavioral Science Uncovered, the podcast about behavioral science and how it is made. You are joining me, Adam Ferris, a doctoral candidate at the University of Oxford studying behavioral environmental economics. Today, I have the great pleasure to introduce Simin Shudi, who is an economics professor at the University of Munich. We will discuss the science and process behind one of Simin's latest projects, entitled The Effect of Incentives in Non-Routine Analytical Team Tasks, which he's working on with Florian Engelmeier, Stefan Grimm, Dominique Grotta, and David Schindler. Simin, it is so nice to have you on the podcast. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Adam. It's a great pleasure to be here today, and I'm very happy to share some of our insights for our work with you and the listeners of this podcast.
Simin, for those who have not read the paper yet, could you please give us a brief overview of what it is about?
Sure. So in a nutshell, this paper studies the causal effects of incentives in non-routine analytical team tasks. So these are tasks in which teams need to acquire and combine information, inform and test hypotheses in order to solve complex problems, frequently in a limited amount of time. So for example, think about teams of IT professionals that develop a new platform for a new customer, or a team of specialist doctors, or some team of management consultants. These all face complex problems, and they need to acquire and combine information, think out of the box in order to succeed. So the core question of whether incentives can help teams to perform better in these tasks was motivated by the fact that these types of tasks have become much more crucial in modern economics or in modern economy. So in the last 60 years, we have witnessed a rapid change in working environments, in particular in the types of tasks input that we observe. So in the old days, a major share of the workforce has performed predominantly manual and repetitive routine tasks with little need to coordinate in teams. Nowadays, instead, work is organized in teams, and actually a large share of the workforce performs tasks that require much more cognitive rather than physical effort. And this is also backed up by empirical work. So David Otter and co-authors have a bunch of different papers showing that the prevalence of these non-routine and complex and interpersonal tasks cover actually a large share of the task input into the US economy. And that's true also for other modern economies. So as such, our project, I think, extends important earlier work that has studied whether monetary incentives can help to improve performance in mechanical and repetitive tasks by now focusing on these complex environments in which tasks are much more non-routine, in which you have to think out of the box. And why is this so important? Well, first of all, evidence is scarce in terms of causal effects coming from field experimental settings that would allow us to understand better whether incentives can improve performance in these settings. And second, there's also good reasons for why we might believe that incentives actually work differently in these tasks as compared to routine repetitive tasks. So let me maybe mention a few reasons for why people might react differently to incentives when they perform these non-routine and complex tasks. So first of all, think about who is performing these tasks. So oftentimes these are people who are really intrinsically motivated to work on challenging problems. You know, to build a new IT platform requires you to have particular skills, but it also requires you to be curious about novel solutions and how you can develop them. So it might be that if you're so intrinsically motivated to work on these complex problems, that extrinsic incentives, like, for instance, monetary incentives in the form of bonuses, could potentially harm the performance of the teams by undermining these workers' intrinsic motivation. Further, these tasks are multifaceted, multidimensional. So offering incentives for one particular dimension might result in unintended shifts of effort away from some dimensions that are not incentivized. Further, the output in these non-routine tasks could be more inconsistent or less deterministically related to effort provision, as we here rely on the combined efforts of different team members. So this task requires more coordination among team members, reducing the effectiveness of incentives potentially, if these incentives are not targeting explicitly at coordinating them. There are many further aspects for why incentives might be less effective in these settings. So it might also be that workers have a more limited knowledge about the production function, so basically how effort translates into productive output. And there's many other reasons that you could think of that result in a quite diverse set of expectations about the efficacy of these incentives. So for instance, research in psychology has pointed to the fact that incentives might lead to focusing, so people might be less likely to think out of the box which could also change the way how these teams and these team members behave. So given this variety of different reasons for why incentives may or may not work in these settings, we thought it's important to actually show whether there is a positive causal effect of incentives in these non-routine team tasks. And what we do in the paper and the project is to study this question in a series of natural field experiments in which we randomly assign actually several hundreds of teams performing such a non-routine team task to different treatment conditions that vary whether these teams are eligible for some bonus if they perform extraordinarily well. What we find is that the incentives actually cause teams to perform better. So we observe substantial positive effects of these monetary incentives. And we show that these effects occur even among strongly intrinsically motivated teams that self-select into performing such a challenging task. So we find that these positive effects occur even among strongly intrinsically motivated teams. And we further document that bonuses also transform team organization as they enhance teams' demand for leadership. So we run a bunch of additional experimental treatments in which we further exogenously increase the demand for leadership and thereby establish a causal link between this increase in leadership and team performance in our setting. And actually, this exogenous increase in the demand for leadership explains a large part of the observed bonus-induced performance improvement.
Thanks a lot for summarizing what you do in this project. Now let's delve into the production process of this paper. I can't ignore the elephant in the room any longer. Your project revolves around using a very novel environmental study, an escape room. How did you and your collaborators come about considering this environment for an experiment? Was it simply a eureka moment following a staff party at your local escape room?
As many others, me and my co-authors were always very intrigued by the concept of these escape challenges. So we were always wondering about the exciting nature of these tasks. And one day, David Schindler and I were discussing over coffee that it could actually be particularly useful to consider these type of environments for economics experiments that relate to teamwork. So we started reflecting on the idea a bit further and then realized that these challenges actually reflect several aspects of non-routine analytical team tasks that have not been studied in great detail in field experiments before. And one particular aspect that we like about the setting is that the setting provides us with three unique and important features that allow us to study the causal effects of incentives in a clean manner. So first, given the nature of these escape challenges, we are able to observe a large number of teams that perform a comparable non-routine task. If you think about firms, in many firm settings, you might have teams, developer teams. They work on tasks that are complex, that require thinking out of the box. But more often than not, you need then to rely on external evaluators who give you a proxy for how good performance is in these tasks, but the tasks are different. In our situation, the tasks are very similar. So basically, people perform the same escape challenge and they only perform it once. The second nice feature of our setting is that we have an objective performance measure, which is the time teams need to complete the task or whether they complete the task at all. So in that sense, we don't need to rely on these external evaluators. We can basically look at how long does it take these teams to finish the task and potentially also look at how many hints they take when working on the task in order to judge their performance in an objective. And finally, and that was the great aspect for us as experimentalists, we were also able to randomly assign a large number of teams to different treatment conditions without a large risk regarding, for instance, contamination. So if you think about varying the incentive structure within firms for different teams, then one of the big risks there would be that other teams learn about these incentive effects. I think also the honest answer in a sense is we always found the setting very exciting. David also had performed one of these challenges actually at the collaborators' site, at our collaboration partner site. Then we delved into thinking about, you know, what are the good features of this setting.
That's perfect. And I am curious, how was the use of an escape room received by the wider academic community pre and post experiment?
So honestly, before running the experiments, we did not discuss the idea of running experiments in escape challenges immediately with many other researchers. But we first wanted to convince ourselves that the features of the team challenge would be relevant and comparable to other complex tasks. So what we did first is we actually tried out ourselves one of those escape challenges of the potential collaboration partner that we were planning to team up with. And we realized that there is actually a very challenging and complex nature to the task. And it captures many of these aspects that are related to other types of teamwork, ranging from the acquisition and combination of information to aspects regarding team organization, how you think about complex problems, and moments in which you really need to think out of the box in order to move forward. So after we were convinced by actually visiting and performing the tasks ourselves, we then started discussing with those colleagues whether or not they would consider the setting something that is interesting and convincing when studying teams that perform complex problems. And we received a lot of positive feedback. Of course, we also at that stage already discussed the issues of external validity, in what sense and how convincing we would consider these settings if we study, for instance, incentive effects in these environments. But overall, we had some positive feedback. So we were kind of optimistic that people would appreciate the novel setting, given the fact that these escape challenges nowadays are also used by companies in the context of recruitment or as alternatives to assessment centers. So in that sense, we had a very good feeling about the idea that this could be something novel and unique and that could be exploited for different experimental or research questions more generally. So we then just decided that the environment is suitable for our purposes and started thinking about how we can get in touch with this escape room provider. So broader feedback from other colleagues and researchers outside our own department was received after we started presenting our work in workshops and conferences. And again, the reactions overall were positive, but also heterogeneous. So one thing that I immediately realized when I was presenting the project in different contexts was that there was a very strong correlation in who considered the task interesting and relevant and for whom it required additional arguments to be convinced that we actually learned something from this particular environment about team performance and how incentives affect team performance. And interestingly, the correlation was that people who had performed these challenges before themselves were immediately convinced, while those who did not have any experience with escape challenges were much more skeptical. And this made it also hard for us, of course, then to write the paper in a convincing way such that we could also convince referees or potential readers of the paper about the manifold advantages of the setting.
So on that note, when it came time to submitting your paper to journals, were you concerned or optimistic about how journals would receive the escape room format then?
Sure. We were very curious to see how referees would react to us using this novel environment. And we also expect again to see some heterogeneity in terms of how much they like the environment. And this is why we also now very carefully discuss the setting and the setting's big advantages, but also the limits in the manuscript. So in the end, I mean, we are convinced that the advantages outweigh the potential disadvantages. Of course, we are a bit biased, but that's part of the game. But I think actually there's good reasons to believe that there's something to be learned from these environments.
Thank you for answering those questions. As you can tell, I'm very intrigued by this escape room format. It is clearly not a typical environment taught in Experimental Economics 101, but maybe it should to be considered for the future. Could you shed some light on how you set up the collaboration with the escape room company that you used, I believe it's called Exit the Room in Munich? I'm intrigued by this particular collaboration as there doesn't seem to be a direct commercial gain for the company.
Yes, that's true. Usually when you start up or when you start these kind of collaborations, you might need to convince your collaboration partner that there's something in for them. And in this case, actually, it was surprisingly simple. So we actually emailed them introducing the idea of a collaboration and explained that we think that there's good reasons for this possible collaboration because it could be interesting, of course, for both of us, the provider and the researchers in particular. We tried to convince them that they are contributing to science by actually helping us understand how motivated teams tackle these challenges and to better understand how teamwork works in complex problems. But then we also, of course, highlighted to them that there might be something that is attractive to them. And there were two key features that we highlighted. The first one was that we could also make Exit the Room more known among the student participants. So that was like the first point that we cared about, to actually kind of offer them the opportunity to have more customers in the end. And at the same time, we also planned and actually eventually also did help them in filling kind of unused times during the day with participants that we would recruit. So in the paper, we report on two different samples. One sample relates to the customer samples. So these are their normal customers that book in advance, pay in advance, go to the site and perform the challenge. And then we have a second sample of student teams that we randomly compose and send there. And so for these student teams, we also compensate the provider for providing the service of providing this escape challenge. So there's also a monetary benefit for the provider in there. But honestly, the first aim they had was in principle to make the company and the particular escape challenges more known among potentially interested customers.
Perfect. So it sounds like a healthy combination of intrinsic and extrinsic working in your favor here. As a young experimentalist, I'm interested in knowing whether you came across any issues getting ethics approval for a field experiment, specifically here where the participants were not made aware of their involvement in a piece of academic research.
Yes, indeed. So that's always an important question. And there's a lot of heterogeneity on how IRBs and ethics committees deal with these kind of projects and requests. I think in our particular case, we made the point that an RCT in which participants are unaware of being studied, so what Harrison and List would call like a natural field experiment, is kind of the gold standard in the literature. And this is something that we really need to do because we don't want to have biases due to study awareness. And that was quite convincing for the ethics committee here. So we didn't have much problems in respect to getting that, but we also needed to exclude some participants, which were minors. So basically here the thoughts on the ethical side were that, you know, minors could be particularly disappointed if they do not win the prize or the bonus that we offer, and that could be detrimental also to their future mental health. So in that sense, the ethics committee or IRB asked us not to include these minors. Which was no problem for us because these are anyways not our focus participants. So we're not interested in how incentives would affect the behavior of these minors. We're interested in how incentives would affect teams of young adults and professionals that we have in these customer samples. So in that respect, actually, we didn't have much problems in terms of the IRB approval.
That's very interesting. Thank you. And may I ask how the project was funded? This was clearly an expensive experiment.
Yes. So indeed, we used several different funding sources to finance all these manifold experiments that we implemented. We used different budgets from different chairs at the Econ department. We got funding from the German Research Foundation, from the Dutch Research Council, and so on. And we used these funding sources for spendings in different regards. So fortunately, all these funding sources were flexible enough for us to accommodate our needs in terms of, you know, not only hiring RAs, but also compensating collaboration partners for providing the escape challenge to the student participants or for running online surveys and with HR experts and so on. So we were quite lucky that we could make the point that this setting is important, and then actually compensating a third party for the provision of a service is fine in that regard.
Perfect. Thank you. That's very interesting. The questions of ethics and funding is not something I necessarily thought about too much pre-PhD. It's maybe naive of me. But then I realize as you get into experimental research, you realize actually that's the bread and butter, the crucial aspects. May I ask, as a consequence of not informing the groups of their participation in the academic research, I presume you face some limitations in terms of your ability to collect individual level demographic data and other control variables that you might have found useful for your analysis. Is that right? Can you tell us more about the constraints you faced on that side of things?
Sure. So indeed, for the experiments with the customers of our collaboration partner, we did not ask for any observable background characteristic. Also to preserve the nature of this natural field experiment in which these participants would not be aware of being studied. So that was like the main reason for us not starting to ask additional questions among the customer sample. Now, as we randomize participants into the different experimental treatments, we basically hope to observe a balanced sample in terms of unobservable characteristics, but we also collected characteristics on observable. So we would see how large the teams are on site. We would see the gender of the team members, the process on how they approach each team when the team arrives is also that they ask whether someone has ever participated in another escape challenge. So we would know whether or not the team is experienced by having at least one of the members being an experienced member. And so on. We also had the RAs actually guess the age of the different participants. And importantly for us, including these factors as a additional control variables does not affect or substantially alter the efficacy of the estimated efficacy of the bonus treatment. But going back to the question, clearly it could also be interesting to study how the efficacy of the treatment varies with other socio-demographic characteristics. So we believe that this type of heterogeneity analysis is very interesting, but it's also not at the core of our research question in the sense of can incentives actually work in these environments? Do they crowd out intrinsic motivation and so on and so forth? So here we were willing to kind of trade off not knowing these characteristics with keeping this naturalness of the setting for these teams.
And looking more closely at the design of your experiment, I saw that the data collection alone took a little under 3 years, starting at the end of 2015 with the control and treatment with the extrinsically rewarded target at 45 minutes, and then ending in 2017 with two additional treatments. Obviously, a certain amount of time was required to collect the couple of hundred groups per treatment arm, but was this the time frame you were expecting when you started the project?
No, not necessarily. So I do not remember all the details that led to all the delays in the data collections, but there were several reasons, in particular capacity constraints on both sides, both on our side in terms of RA capacities and then also on the collaboration of partner side in terms of how many bookings they had at what time and also at what points in time they were willing to have us in their setting actually running these experiments. Concerning the additional treatments, I think you were also mentioning those and why they happened a bit later. We realized when discussing already our design with other colleagues that it could be extremely helpful to add these two treatments. So basically one treatment relates to the reference point that the incentive provides. So we gave the bonus incentive for 45 minutes. As such, the treatment as compared to the control condition highlights both that, you know, 45 minutes is some performance goal or threshold that seems somehow relevant, and at the same time providing a monetary incentive. So we then added this treatment where we just mentioned the 45 minutes is something that signals a good performance, and we added another treatment, this bonus 60 treatment, in which we paid a bonus, but for the threshold that is the usual threshold. So here in this challenge, usually people have 60 minutes to complete the challenge. So we introduced these additional treatments, but we ran them in parallel with the original treatments in 2017. So basically we recollected additional data for the original main treatments plus these two additional treatments such that we would again randomize on the daily level to see whether there's any differences between these treatments and then control for basically time fixed effects in our analyses. Why did it take so long? So in terms of capacities, we also collected the data on the student sample in 2016, which also required lots of RA efforts. So there was something else going on in the meantime. In that sense, I think it's a combination of different reasons for the delays, which caused this long delay in terms of the data collection, plus some learning in terms of which additional aspects could be relevant to which led to this inclusion of these two additional treatments. I mean, eventually, I think it's nice that we have collected all this data because now we can really show that the performance improvement comes about through the reward provided by the incentive and not through the reference point or the threshold component of the incentives.
And given, I'm intrigued, given that the data collection alone took almost 3 years, could you give us a timeline for the whole project from A to Z?
I wish I could. So in the beginning, we clearly planned this project as part of a larger research agenda. in which we would also collect data on other incentive types, which we also eventually did, and also collect some data on leadership interventions. But to provide you with a rough time frame, I mean, we talked about the project, I think, the very first time in 2015, and we started thinking about what is feasible and thinking about what kind of resources do we have, what kind of resources do we need, who should be among the team. At some point after collecting the data, we received some skepticism regarding the setting in our first submission, which ended in a rejection in 2018. And then after revising the manuscript substantially, in particular in terms of laying out the pros and cons of the settings, so what we have discussed earlier, hopefully being better at convincing people about the relevance and the importance of the setting, we resubmitted the paper at another journal, and we then received a reject and resubmit from the JPE that asked for additional data collection, and which required us to design actually new experiments and run several online surveys. So it took a lot of preparatory work to design these experiments. And when we were eventually ready to collect this additional data, COVID hit us. So basically, we planned to run these experiments in April 2020, and we completely failed, of course. And then we tried to run the experiments in different countries. We were in touch with people in New Zealand at the time, and New Zealand was still COVID-free. It didn't work out. We tried to get in touch with people in Israel and so on. But in the end, we ran the experiments in 2021. Yeah, and then after we had finally collected this data, we rewrote the manuscript, included the results, we submitted the paper, and then this eventually led to a revise and resubmit, which we were very happy and thankful about. And at the point we are speaking, we have now already worked on the revision and have submitted it back to the journal. So we all very much hope that now the editor and the referees really like the new version of our paper, which has now been complemented both with additional results from online surveys with HR experts, but also with additional results from a project that was a companion project in which we studied the exogenous effect of, in which we studied the effects of a leadership encouragement treatment in which we exogenously increased the demand for leadership in teams. And I think actually as such, I mean, it was a very, very long process. And definitely longer than expected. And the paper has been substantially revised several times. But I think actually many important aspects have been added. So it was a long process, but I recently compared, also in preparation for our podcast today, I compared like early versions with the current version. And I'm really convinced that the paper became much stronger during the process. Although during the process, at some points, of course, you would hope that things move on faster, but in the end, I think now it's a very comprehensive paper that makes a really important point.
Perfect. Well, I have my fingers and toes crossed for you for the resubmission.
Thank you.
So this clearly was a very long project, and you have several co-authors, which makes sense considering the mammoth size of the experiment. But with this kind of time frame, I'm kind of interested in the evolving nature of this collaboration with your co-authors, and how did that affect how work was split and shared?
So first of all, I have to say that, I mean, I like all my co-authors a lot, but for this particular project, this is really composed of a favorite set of my co-authors, because this is a very long-term project and it requires a lot of trust in your colleagues, and also of commitment of everyone. And I'm very happy to say that everyone who was involved in the project and still is involved in the project really contributed their share. Of course, the roles within the project were different in the sense that the more senior colleagues were less involved in the organization at the ground. So, you know, like setting up the individual sessions for collecting the data and so on. But everyone actually was involved in like the experimental design stage, the general planning, the analysis of the results, and also writing the manuscript. And of course, the team also helped us in terms of being productive on other projects in parallel. So, you know, apart from potential teaching loads, you also work on other projects at the same time. And you're also setting up like a broader agenda. So, this helped us also manage, this workload in a reasonable manner.
And so taking a step back for a second, all things considered, what do you think were the most challenging aspects of the project? I suspect the timeline is going to be a factor here, but is there anything you would have done differently, perhaps, in hindsight?
Yeah, I think in hindsight, there's always some improvements, you know, that you see that you haven't seen up front. For example, I think, and that's actually true for other projects as well, I think sometimes it's really important to prioritize one project over another. And in this case, for this large-scale project, maybe I should have put even more priority on that project as compared to others at some points of the process. So, for example, when we were redesigning these additional, when we were designing these additional experiments pre-COVID, I was extremely frustrated when the pandemic hit us. So, and I was really reconsidering how much faster could we have been in setting up everything and running the experiments earlier and getting that done and potentially with a even prioritizing the project more, although it was, I would say, basically almost always at the top of the list. Would have been maybe something that I could have done differently. But at some points, you know, it's also important to take a step back and actually reflect on things you've written. So for me, for instance, it's very useful to write on a manuscript and then actually not look at the manuscript. And then after some time, look at the manuscript again to better understand whether what I've written in the past is actually convincing my new present self. So I think sometimes this distance to what you've done is actually also helpful. Yeah, and I think more generally, like the core feature for any successful project is co-authors. So it's that skills of co-authors are complementary, but more importantly, I think also that you can trust in your co-authors and that everyone's committed, as I said before. So fortunately, this was the case for us and still is the case for us. So I think I'm very lucky in that respect.
I like your suggestion of taking a step back after you've written a first draft or two of your manuscript and then taking a break and then coming back to see if you're still convinced or if it still makes sense. I think that's something I should probably do more often as well. So you've mentioned once or twice already that the project in this that you're describing this paper is part of a wider research program. So presumably you've used or you plan to use escape rooms in further or future studies. How did your initial work inform subsequent research designs or kind of methodologies?
So I think the very first project helped us in particular to better understand on the one hand the variation in the outcome variables that we observe. So we have a much better understanding by now, you know, how the finishing times are distributed in general in the setting. So this allows us to better estimate the number of observations we would need and what we could consider reasonable and identifiable effect sizes. So whether something is a relevant effect or not somehow depends a bit on how much variation you have in these outcome variables. And second, the project also led us to consider additional channels. So for instance, with the student samples, we also had these participants complete a bunch of different questions related to team organization. And one thing that we saw was that teams in the incentive condition were much more likely to report that there was a demand for leadership in the team. So people were hoping that someone would take the lead and actually motivate or coordinate the team. And this made us think about this additional treatment, this additional project in which we looked at this exogenous variation in leadership. So basically, this was something that was really kind of stimulated through these original results that we said, well, if we see that the treatments affect perceived demand for leadership, maybe if we just shift this demand, if we exogenously encourage teams to consider having someone who takes the leading role, or takes over the leading role in the team, that could be something that is actually effective. And this really resulted in this additional project. And then, of course, you know, when we started working on incentives, we already were discussing, okay, what are the right incentives to be studied? Is it bonus incentives? Is it piece rates? Is it tournaments and so on? And we said that actually bonus incentives are very interesting. They're also are used in different settings, so it's worthwhile to study them. But we would also be interested in more competitive elements. So we had a companion project on tournament incentives. We didn't do a piece rate condition yet, but there's also constraints in terms of, you know, how many observations we can collect and how how novel the results in this respect could be or would be. So we didn't do that yet. We have other follow-up work. So basically, regarding the leadership treatment, we were also becoming interested in how important it is that teams that work in these kind of flat hierarchies, that they are actually able to choose or influence who their team lead actually is, or whether exogenously assigned leaders would also help teams improve their performance. So we have follow-up work on this. And of course, also the discussion about expectations is important. So what do experts, what do practitioners consider relevant for the success of teamwork? So is it how a team is governed? Is it the incentive structure? Is it the hierarchical structure? Is it team composition and so on? And the nice thing now is that we have data in which we have exogenous variation in different underlying factors. For instance, in the student teams, we randomly compose these teams. So we have exogenous variation in the gender composition and other underlying factors that characterize these workers. And so we can contrast that with expectations of experts. So we have a follow-up work in which we collected data in online discrete choice experiments in which we try to estimate what is the perceived relative importance of different team characteristics and governance structures, and then contrast that with predictions that we would make based on our actual performance data. So there is an agenda.
That's really fascinating. And I find it quite interesting as well how frequently these projects kind of spill over one into the next, or they have this kind of knock-on effect where you observe a little bit of a side idea or something that you weren't quite expecting, and then that leads to more and more papers. And then hopefully in 50 years' time, you can retire knowing that you've figured out the complete bubble. Anyway, so finally, to conclude the podcast, I'd like to throw you the impossible question that I always ask. What single piece of advice would you give to early career researchers trying to write a publishable paper?
It's a tough question. But I think my main recommendation is you should believe in your idea. So you should try to find out early on whether you believe in the idea, and then also whether others believe in the same idea too. And if yes, then I think you need to work hard on finding the right setting, the right data, the right methods to answer the question. By the way, I think you should also make sure that it is a research question. So it should be like a sentence with a question mark at the end. Sometimes people start out by saying, oh, it's so fascinating to study these markets, things are happening, but it's not clear where they're going. And I think like really constraining yourself to say, I have to explain my research. I should have one question that's a sentence with a question mark at the end. And that's very, very helpful. And as long as you have that, I think then, yeah, don't hesitate to go the extra mile. And please, ideally in anticipation, the critical referees that might, you know, make these comments on your paper later on. So you can try to make the paper bulletproof before they come up with this question. So anticipate these critical opinions and do not simply ignore comments that you receive early on where you see that people raise some criticism repeatedly. So long answer to a short question. But I think if you believe in your idea and others do, then usually it's good to pursue it. But it's also fine to, you know, give up on an idea early on. I think people more often than not are reluctant to quit early enough, but sometimes it's very helpful too, and just switch to another project that looks more interesting.
But it sounds like you haven't been put off the idea of these big novel experimental environments.
No, because I believed in the setting, and I think it's an interesting setting, and I think it has many interesting features. So for that reason, we kept working on the idea and kept working on the setting, and we still believe it's an interesting setting. So that doesn't mean that I want to write, I don't know, 20 more papers on escape challenges. But if there is a setting that allows you to study particular questions that are relevant and where the setting is just unique in terms of how you can answer the questions, you should exploit it also. You should also, you know, make use of it and not just ignore it.
Thank you so much. That makes complete sense. And thank you for your honest answers to all of my questions today. As a student starting off their academic career, it's very interesting to hear your process, notice some of the patterns, and indeed the heterogeneity in how project seeds are sown as well. Thank you so much for taking part in this podcast.
Thank you so much, Adam. It was a great pleasure, and I was really happy to talk about the paper with you.
No, thank you.